Heading into Black History Month, we'll hear stories about Harriet Tubman, Nat Turner, and Dr. King. But there are so many other fascinating stories to tell.
This was a place where school kids and mothers and communities were really imagining and defining freedom.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a remarkable school for young Black students in 19th century New York City. We'll also spend an academic minute with a not-so-well-known African-American historian. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The New York African Free School was established while slavery was still legal in New York. While doing research on the school, Anna Mae Duane, an associate professor of English and director of the American Studies program at the University of Connecticut, discovered the remarkable stories of two young men who played a huge role in the abolition movement. She tells their story in her new book, Educated for Freedom, the incredible story of two fugitive schoolboys who grew up to change the nation. I spoke with Dr. Duane and asked why she felt it was important to tell these stories.
Yeah, I came across them as a PhD student some years ago, and I was in the New York Historical Society, and I came across a school that I couldn't believe kind of existed, the New York African Free School. And I came across records that I couldn't believe that were there, which included schoolwork, plays, drawings of these kids who had attended this school. And the more I dug, the more I realized that this was a story we didn't know about Black achievement, Black imagination, about what freedom could mean. We think of the years leading up to the Civil War as, either you're running for freedom or fighting for freedom or being given freedom by the legislators, by Abraham Lincoln is the sort of go-to. But this was a place where school kids and mothers and communities were really imagining and defining freedom in ways that I think we don't know enough about.
And who are the two young men?
Yes. So I didn't know this when I first started research into the school, but they went on to incredible lives of both achievement and, I'd say, adventure. James McCune Smith, who is one of my subjects, became the first African-American to earn an MD here in the 1830s, so 35 years before the end of the Civil War. The other person I think about is Henry Highland Garnett, who was a minister, largely considered a radical, and was the first African-American to address Congress. Researching both of them was tricky because they didn't come from wealthy families. They're both actually the sons of enslaved mothers. So it was tricky to try to figure out who they were from the beginning, right? We don't have all these letters and archives. James McCune Smith at school is a little easier to find. His work is everywhere. He gets to address the Marquis de Lafayette when he comes to visit the school. And he's just sort of the pet student. He sort of pursues this all his life, that he believes in the promise of America, that if you stay and work hard and reason with people, that prejudice can be overcome. Henry Highland Garnett, his records are nowhere in the school. I know about him from the memories of his friends who remember him as this like incredibly charismatic student. He would have meetings in which he would get his fellow teenage students to sort of pledge their lives to fighting for freedom. They said, we're going to get our education and we're going to go down south and we're going to change this. But his personality and the things that happened to him in his life led him to change his mind a lot, to be a lot less trusting that things would just work out if we just trusted and worked hard. In the end, he eventually, at least for a while, believes that African-Americans shouldn't stay in America at all, that they'd be better off leaving entirely, that that was the best way for them to achieve real freedom.
like to go back just a little bit and talk about the school itself. How was this school founded? And, I mean, slavery was still legal when this school was running.
Absolutely. When it was founded in 1787, so the ink is not dry on the Constitution yet, New York State is still a slave state at this point, and it's founded by founding fathers. Alexander Hamilton is involved, John Jay, who's sort of this New York elite founding father, and a group of elite men. They call themselves the New York Manumission Society, and manumission is just sort of a fancy word for abolition. They think freedom is going to come eventually. They believe it should come, and there's this belief that we need to get ready for it. And so they set up this school for the children of basically enslaved people. At that point, they were certainly free people of color. But at that point, that is like we needed to get the next generation ready for what freedom would look like, for what citizenship would look like. And the school goes on till 1833. When my two guys are attending it, it's about the 1820s. And it's New York is still a slave state. New York is a slave state till 1827.
The school went by the teachings of a Joseph Lancaster. Who was he, and what was his theory of education?
Oh, my gosh. He is a fascinating character. There needs to be a book on him as well. He was sort of this English schoolmaster that wasn't doing terribly well for a while, and then he comes up with this system that just gets embraced worldwide. We're sort of coming into the Industrial Revolution, and the system reflects that. There's a lot of timing your movements. There's a lot of emphasis on efficiency. But one of the more remarkable innovations was that he decided, well, you know, we don't need to have one schoolmaster and all the students sort of emulating this one schoolmaster in this sort of close relationship. Let's industrialize this. We'll get one schoolmaster and we'll distribute the teaching among the students. So you would compete for the honor of being what they would call a monitor, and you got to be basically an assistant teacher. And you would drill your group of peers, and you'd be responsible for teaching them the lesson for the day. And the schoolmaster would kind of supervise from on high, but the actual work of teaching and correcting was done by the students themselves.
And that one schoolmaster you spoke of, that's Charles Andrews. What was his effect on the lives of these two young men?
So I think that there's a couple of ways to think about his effect. He, by all accounts, was interested in the students and believed in them. James McCune Smith would talk about how he would like find out what you were good at and help you to develop it. So I think that in some ways that was very positive. And certainly James McCune Smith, of course, being the good student, remembered him very fondly. But I also think there was not a negative, certainly a confusing aspect that he had on them, because he had this issue of he would educate these students, take pride in these students, and then you'd send them out into the world in 1818, 1820. And, of course, there's very little opportunity for them. He writes very eloquently in the records about the star student of that moment who was incredibly talented and couldn't even get a job as a blacksmith. Just racism shut him out of every shop. No one would work with him. No one would hire him. And that student decides to go to Liberia, which was a new colony in Africa, to have a fighting chance. And so he becomes invested in this idea that, okay, that's what all the students should do. That's the best chance for them. So he's teaching them to be their best, but he's also giving them the message, you're not going to be able to be your best here in America. And this is sort of the contradictory lesson that both men kind of have to wrestle with, and the community at large, for the rest of their lives. Where can we thrive?
And that question of colonization, that really was a wedge between these two men, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, in the community and in the abolitionist movement, one of the things I learned researching this book is that early on, so the 1820s, the 1830s, this is what everybody thought was the right idea. The most advanced, at least white abolitionists, so men like William Lloyd Garrison, who was sort of at the forefront of calling for radical abolition, still believed that, yeah, once we get freedom, I don't see how it's going to work in this country. And it's actually the black community that pushes back against this. But this idea is very powerful, you know, right up until the 1860s. Abraham Lincoln is investigating this right up until he's signing the Emancipation Proclamation. Right? This just doesn't go away in terms of how white reformers were imagining what freedom would look like. So for these two men, this is sort of the central question of how their future is going to unfold. And as I said, James McCune Smith, who's sort of a builder, who's very stable, who's a doctor, never loses faith that America is the place to stay. But Henry Helen Garnett changes his mind in the 1850s and says, I don't know if this is the place for us to stay. And that causes their 30-year friendship to really fracture. And I always think of it as sort of the equivalent of a Twitter beef. They really have at each other in the newspapers, just accusing each other of not really having their community's best interest in mind. This is sort of a history we think was settled, but it was very much in play of sort of, are we really Americans? Can we see a future for ourselves here?
Well, Garnett had every reason to feel that way, where he pretty much lost his entire family to the people trying to, you know, capture slaves.
Yes. I mean, his life and researching it, I just couldn't get over how often this trauma, how the way slavery just keeps coming back and disrupting his life, even after it's abolished, even when he's in a free state, no matter where he goes. So, yes, I mean, as a 14-year-old kid, he himself had escaped from slavery in Maryland at 9. So he's in New York. He's at this great school. You know, he's just come back from sort of a side job working as a cabin boy, and his whole family is gone. His apartment is wrecked. And what had happened was slavery is still legal at this point in New York, and even for several years after it's technically abolished, you would have slave catchers come from the South and grab people. And once you got people back down South, no one was too worried about what your papers looked like. And this is what happened. They came knocking on the door, and his next-door neighbor describes how the father had to jump over rooftops, how the mother escapes through the neighbors, and how they capture his sister. His reaction, which I think sort of tells you a little bit about the sort of man he would be, is to grab a knife and to run up and down Broadway, just looking to fight to get his family back, which, of course, is an incredibly dangerous thing for a young African-American man to be doing. And this disruption keeps happening to him. He will help on the Underground Railroad throughout his life. And so he's always been very close to this idea that you think you're free, you think you're okay. And if people just, you know, if it's convenient for the people in power, it's all going to evaporate.
Well, Dr. Smith, James Smith, he had a much different experience, but he did it abroad, right?
Yes. He's just so talented and so brilliant that he manages at 14 to inspire both white and black benefactors to raise the money to send him to the University of Glasgow to get his medical degree. He had applied to Columbia and a few other places in the U.S., and they absolutely turned him down on account of his complexion, was the term they used. And he goes to the University of Glasgow, and by all accounts, he was highly respected. They send him off with a big goodbye ceremony. It's not as if he doesn't have to deal with prejudice. He certainly does. But in some ways, he's able to stay stable enough. And he just believes in building from the ground up. So I think it's both sort of the life he had and his temperament that he said, no, I'm going to start a pharmacy. I'm going to invest in the next generation of black children. I'm going to stay here. And anything else is really a betrayal. He believes in sort of the American dream. Despite all the evidence he's seeing to the contrary all around him, he believes you just keep working, it's going to pay off.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Anna Mae Duane continues with a look at how some free nations in Europe were still supporting slavery. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website, Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Anna Mae Duane, an associate professor of English and director of the American Studies program at the University of Connecticut. Her new book is called Educated for Freedom, The Incredible Story of Two Fugitive Schoolboys Who Grew Up to Change a Nation. One of those students spent time in a non-slave country in Europe, but still saw support for slavery in their trade economy.
That is one of the places I find him. He's often considered a radical, largely because he's much more vociferous about sort of what black people should do to overthrow slavery. But I also think he's a radical in thinking about sort of the economic power of slavery. And that's why when he goes to England later on and Scotland and other places, he's walking into sort of a circuit, an abolitionist circuit, where the British are very happy to pat themselves on the back for being morally superior and having abolished slavery and all that. And he's very quick to say, no, this isn't something you can cut off at the border. This is a global capitalist system, and you're processing the cotton, and you're buying the cotton that is purchased with the blood of slaves. And we need to really rethink this whole system. Passing one law is not going to do it. You know, and so one of the ways he wants to think about this is to sort of think about economic boycott, economic action, consumer activism, a century before we think of it now. Right? But in many ways, he sees this as a global system and it needs a global solution.
You talk about how Garnett had gone over to across the Atlantic to Europe. Why did he come back? Was it Frederick Douglass? Was it that call?
Yes, that we haven't talked about Frederick Douglass yet, who's a big character in this book and a friend with both men. And actually, he and Garnett have quite a rivalry in terms of they're both incredible orators and incredibly charismatic. And Douglass, like James McCune Smith, sees it as a betrayal when Garnett leaves in the 1850s. He says, we need you here now. You're one of our best men. We need your argument. You know, we're finally catching up to your idea that we need to sort of stand up and actively fight for our own freedom, and you've gone off to Europe. So Frederick Douglass in the newspaper chastises him, and I think that does have an effect. But he also comes back because he suffers a family tragedy. He had adopted a young fugitive girl, and she passes away in Jamaica, where he eventually goes as a minister. And I think he just decides he wants to go home. He doesn't want to have his family so far from where he comes to realize is his real home. He wants to come back. And so he comes back to sort of join the fray in the 1850s.
Well, both of these men lost children in the 1850s.
Yes, and, you know, I think studying this era, it's just remarkable about you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who hadn't lost a child, and we sort of gloss over that. Either we don't notice it or we don't think it has that big of an effect. And I think it changes both of their lives and both of their political outlook. And one of the things that I realized writing this book is that it starts with them as children, but children are players throughout this book in ways big and small. And one is sort of their grief for their own children changes their hopes and dreams about their own future and the future of their community. And it makes them both sort of change paths when they're confronted with these losses.
How were these men affected by the outbreak of the Civil War?
Right. In some ways, their friendship had been fractured by this debate over colonization and whether African Americans should stay in the country or leave. When the Civil War breaks out, it sort of brings them back together. Now, and they're not alone in this, right? Largely across the African American community, people are thinking, well, now there's hope, right? Now we can actually see an end to this possibly. So they both are working in New York City. Now Henry Highland Garnett and Frederick Douglass are working side by side recruiting African-American soldiers, trying to get them to join the Union Army to fight for their freedom. James McCune Smith is celebrating alongside them both as we sort of see emancipation documents start to come through. And it's sort of this hopeful time for both of them where they sort of see, at least in the beginning of the war, they see hope. They're seeing sort of the possibility of slavery ending, which had been their dream since their childhood. And they had, you know, I don't think in their wildest dreams they wouldn't have imagined they would see it in their own lifetimes.
You talk about, too, how the draft riots of 1863 affected both of them.
Yes, right. So there is this sort of hopeful moment where it seems as if America is fighting for you. Garnett at one point says, like, look at that flag. We can finally say it's our flag. And then in 1863, one of the issues that comes up around recruiting is that while Garnett and Douglas are recruiting soldiers, black soldiers, the New York governor will not let them serve. He does not want black men armed. He won't let them serve in the New York Brigade. And because of that, their numbers are low and they have to institute a draft, which largely just affects poor and working class white men, right? Because the richer people can sort of buy their way out of it. And the city just explodes one morning once the draft gets started. And the violence is quite incredible. People are murdered in the streets. It goes on for days on end. They attack houses. They attack the New York Colored Orphan Asylum, which had been basically James McCune Smith's life work. And we say an orphan asylum, but it was actually this beautiful building with a swimming pool. It was on 5th and 42nd Street. It was basically this school and institution that was doing the same work that James McCune Smith had benefited from, sort of educating and caring for young black children and getting them ready for the freedom that was coming. And the mob comes and destroys the entire building. They come looking for Henry Highland Garnett. He escapes by luck, basically. And after 3 days, they come out and the city is in ruins. Hundreds and hundreds of black people have been displaced. Dozens and dozens have been killed, men, women, and children. And they sort of are confronted again with the rugs sort of being pulled out from under them. They thought they were making all this progress. And then in the blink of an eye, they're just in a very different reality.
Well, let's go to just a few days after Lincoln proposes the 13th Amendment. Garnett addresses the House of Representatives. What was that speech and what was the impact of that speech?
Right. So here again, we have another huge shift, right? So we have this sort of moment of hopelessness. And then 2 years later, the war is over and the 13th Amendment has been offered for ratification. And they want the most talented black orator in the nation. And they don't call Frederick Douglass. They call Henry Howard Garnett. Or I guess they write a letter. They're not calling. People talk about that speech as something you would never forget. And if they thought that Henry Highland Garnett was going to go before Congress and just sort of say, thank you, we're happy now, like everything's taken care of, they were mistaken. He speaks to them and says, we're not done yet. Right? This is not freedom yet. The nation has more debts to pay. We need to keep fiercely fighting for an idea of freedom that both black and white people agree to, that is real equality. And he, you know, in that speech, you can sort of see his worry that maybe this isn't really over, which, you know, again, his whole life story has sort of reminded him of the ways things can change very quickly. And so that speech is prescient in lots of ways of saying this is a great moment, but we're not done. Freedom isn't here yet. And at this moment, his friend, James McCune Smith, is back in New York City quite ill. He'd had I think congestive heart failure, you know, had been bothering him in the years leading up, and the riots really largely broke his heart in many ways. But he asked this friend who he had been fighting with and made up with and had, you know, spent his whole life wrestling with these ideas about, to write the introduction, to basically write his biography and to introduce this historic speech to the world. So this is sort of the last moment where, again, they're collaborating and thinking about what the future will hold.
In the end, what's the legacy of the New York African Free School?
I think the legacy is that we need to rethink what freedom, how freedom came about in the years leading up to the Civil War, that it's places like this with brave young people who were told that freedom was never going to be theirs, who weren't considered when we were writing the laws, right, who were told they weren't quite ready yet, and how powerful their imagination and their bravery was, and how much we owe people whose name we might not know the country we're in today, like what freedom has come to mean.
Again, the name of Dr. Anna Mae Duane's new book is Educated for Freedom, the incredible story of two fugitive schoolboys who grew up to change a nation. A second generation of African-American historians is preserving Black history for future generations. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Who was Lawrence Reddick? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, David Canton, associate professor of history, discusses this marginalized scholar from the recent past.
Lawrence Dunbar Reddick was the second curator of the Schomburg Collection of Negro Literature, now the Schomburg Center for the Research in Black Culture. He was also a university librarian, a college professor, and a scholar activist. His contemporaries included preeminent Black scholars such as E. Franklin Frazier, Horace Mann Bond, Benjamin Quarles, Charles S. Johnson, and St. Clair Drake. Between 1930 and 1943, 22 African Americans had received their Ph.D. in history. In 1939, Reddick received his Ph.D. in history from the University of Chicago and was part of what I refer to as the second generation of Black professional historians. The first generation of Black professional historians were W.E.B. Du Bois, Carter G. Woodson, and Charles Wesley. Jim Crow forced these scholars to teach at Black colleges and universities, and only a few were recognized by white scholars, published in white journals, and had an opportunity to teach at white universities. However, rather than view Reddick as a marginalized Black scholar in white academia, my research locates Reddick as a central figure in the world of Black scholarship and activism. Reddick played a major role in the dissemination, preservation, and development of Black history in the academy, the Black community, and white American public. And he had an undying faith in the power of Black history as a mechanism to cultivate race pride, dismantle racism, and improve race relations.
That was David Canton of Connecticut College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. ¶¶